Thank you very much, Gary. Sometimes I'm a little concerned when somebody starts to introduce me. You get a little worried because you never know what they're going to say. And it's not always clear in advance that it's going to be things you want to hear, but never mind. And thank you very much for saying all the things that I like to hear as well. But before I speak, and I want to speak to you perhaps for about 15 minutes, because I understand there might be some time for questions or exchange and dialogue afterwards as well, I want to thank you all for this unique opportunity to visit this university here. Thank you very much. And for the privilege to be able to share and to learn with you over the next couple of days. I would also, in particular this evening, though, like to take this unique chance to publicly thank Cole and all of his colleagues and the people who work with him for the support that they have given me in the international work that I've been concerned with, for the small contribution I've been able to make internationally in support of freedom of religion and belief. I would like to take this chance to acknowledge publicly also Cole's own contribution to work on religious freedom. And I think through that, I feel very, very much the way he has been able personally to enhance understanding and respect for religion and belief, and for his own religion and beliefs, not just in this country, but in very, very many parts of the world. And I'm very glad to be able to say that here in his home university, because I'm very conscious that very often those of us who work in many places, here, there, and yonder, we come home, we run in the door, and we run out again, and maybe we leave people wondering what we're doing when we're outside it. So can I just assure you that everything that I know about the work of Cole Durham and all the support I've had from him leads me to conclude that his contribution is a truly wonderful one, and one I'm very happy to have had some small association with. I attach great importance to connecting communities of discourse for a more just, tolerant, and equal world, where freedom, including religious freedom, is cherished. For me, this has been very much the way that I have tried to work as an activist in civil society, as a chair and a leader of various national and international organizations, and as an academic. It seems to me that at this time of great global challenges and uncertainties, such connections, which are ever more important, won't come about simply by wishing them into existence. And from that point of view alone, I very much welcome this opportunity over these few days to engage in what I hope and I know will be robust and engaging discussion about how they can be made possible. To connect communities of discourse, parity of esteem is required across divisions and disciplines, with deep-seated perceptions of our own uniqueness, whichever bit we happen to come from, and superiority. And we also need moves, I believe, towards integration of issues and dimensions that are seldom treated together. We need to get beyond the parallel lines and the railway tracks, which often divide those of us who are trying to systematically work in the same direction. Connectedness for me means not only just being aware of other issues and dimensions, but also taking them on board in discourse and in action. With regard to religious freedom, denial of discrimination and dismissal of associated hate crime. These demand not just legal absence of such things, but also respect. Respect, in turn, demands recognition of diversity, difference, and rights for the minorities and the groups, and for the men and the women who are different. Laws and regulations, both in your country and in mine and in many countries globally, help in this way. But real respect and recognition, in my view, can only be realised if there is redistribution of power and resources. And our various global and national histories don't give us much to be proud of in that regard. Histories of colonization, domination, and exploitation challenge us continually. Religious freedom, then, I'm suggesting, demands respect, recognition, and essentially redistribution of power and resources, perhaps also within religions. And I make no apology for speaking as a woman in that regard. Connecting communities of discourse is an essential prerequisite in this process. And I'm sure we can make some progress in that regard in these coming days. As part of my modest contribution to this opening session, I would like now to point to some of the conclusions and comments that my own work in Ireland as part of, as chair of the National Consultative Committee on Racism and Interculturalism, and also as a member of the Irish Council of State more recently, and as part of a number of European Union, European and regional-wide institutions, has led me to. Before doing this, since these institutions and realities have shaped my thinking, let me contextualise my remarks by saying a little bit about Ireland, and forgive me if I'm boring you with that, and a little bit about the European Union and the Fundamental Rights Agency, which I chair. Now, Ireland, in case you didn't know, and maybe you don't, was colonised for 700 years by the British. We have lots of songs and we have lots of different ways of telling the story. And over in the last 200 years of that period of colonisation, the Irish diaspora are to be found in virtually every part of the world, and certainly every part of the United States of America. However, the exploitation that we experienced ourselves as part of a diaspora was no insurance against our capacity to discriminate against others. And I say that as one of the things I think we need to think of as we debate these things, that our own exploitation, marginalisation and oppression doesn't insulate us fully from repeating the process when given the opportunity. And I have to say with some sadness that as the so-called Celtic tiger took off in our country over the last decade, he or she has now run away entirely, though. We were not so good at looking at how to treat the people who came to contribute to the success of that tiger. Our 1937 constitution gave a special place to the Catholic Church, as indeed many new countries, emerging democracies do to the religion they feel has been oppressed in the period before they got freedom. This position has been more or less removed now by a referendum of the people. And the removal of the Catholic Church from a special position in our constitution has in no way diminished the power, influence, or credibility of the church. Through the work that took place in the last decade on challenging racism on a more positive side as well, interculturalism and through promoting integration, structured dialogue with churches and faith communities, including also non-confessional bodies, was established by our government in 2007. And this has been a very positive development, a development which I believe in terms of bringing together different communities has been able to contribute to the diversity that's part of Ireland now. But debate about the institutional role of religion in our society has not gone away. And in particular, some of you may be aware, because the reports have been also made here due to the fact that a number of the people who are abused are now living in the USA, reports of abuse of young people in institutions run by religious over the period between the 1950s and the 1980s have done nothing to make that institutional role more positive. Again, when one looks to try to explain what happened, one cannot but look to the way in which our fledgling democracy at that time was dependent on a partnership with the Catholic Church in order to provide the social policy mechanisms and the social policy responses that were required to make living in Ireland possible. More recently, many of our partners in Europe have looked a little bit askance at the reintroduction of the offence of blasphemy into our legal system. A position that's seen as inconsistent with Ireland's own position on defamation of religion, and I'd have to admit to you that it probably, to many of us, looks as though it probably is. But the way in which the offence has been put, has been described will in fact make it quite difficult for a case to be taken, and even more difficult for such a case to be proven. However, the very introduction of the offence, which to be honest was not done at the behest of the religious communities, all of whom stated that they did not require it, again, I think gives evidence of the intricacies that are involved when we try to pick our way towards a climate in which religious freedom is acknowledged and respected for all. To turn to the European Union then, on Friday, my own country voted to ratify the Lisbon Treaty, which will give legal status to the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union, linking civil, political, social and economic rights recognised in the Union. This has been an interesting process for Ireland because we have a history of saying no every time we're asked by an institution we see as more powerful. So we said no the first time they presented the Lisbon Treaty to us, and with a certain amount of persuasion agreed to say yes on this occasion. In effect, the Lisbon Treaty, the Charter of Fundamental Rights, which will be written into the law of the European Union as a result of the treaty, builds a little bit on Article 6 of the original Treaty of the European Union and also on the Treaty of Amsterdam, which outlaws discrimination. In this European context, there are very interesting discussions continuing, though, about the role of institutional religion. In France, as you will know, secularism is considered to be of most importance. And in spite of media discourse to the contrary, the role of religion in education in the UK and indeed in Ireland is of particular significance. An interesting challenge to the European Union going forward, and an interesting challenge to the Member States after the Lisbon Treaty has been finally ratified, will be to find ways to encompass the various cultures and the very diverse ways of thinking about fundamental rights and about how they should be articulated and how they should be understood and how discrimination against them should actually be outlawed across the whole of the Union. In the field of discrimination, the legislation, the directives that were put in place forbidding discrimination on a variety of grounds in the workplace and forbidding discrimination on the basis of racism have been effective. But they have also led to continued discussion, which has become more heightened after what was referred to in Europe, and I'm sure here, as the Danish cartoons controversy. They've become more heightened then, and I suppose you could put them down to that struggle to balance freedom of expression with freedom from discrimination. That struggle to look to ways to prohibit incitement to hatred on one hand, while at the same time not enforcing people to love one another in a rather surface-like fashion. New European legislation around the framework decision on racism and hate crime will have the potential to walk just that tightrope. From these engagements and from these involvements, a number of things have struck me. Firstly, the gap between political discourse on one hand, which often brings with it a big defence of law and of policy and practice, versus the reality of people's lived experiences, to me seems to be widening. For many years, I've been actively involved in work with groups referred to in Europe as Roma, Sinti, and Travellers. Many countries have legislation, and indeed the European Union enforces legislation also, banning discrimination, including against Roma, Sinti, and Travellers. And yet the research that we've undertaken in the Fundamental Rights Agency demonstrates very clearly that there is a big gap between the discourse, the law, and what is referred to as implementation of the law on one hand, and the reality of people's lived experience on the other hand. The Fundamental Rights Agency of the European Union, which I chair, was established in 2007, and I have a whole series of notes about it that I'll make available to people, so I won't waste too much time saying too much about it. As an independent agency of the Union, with a board membership of one independent expert from each member state, a staff based in Vienna, and then contracted experts in each of the member states. What we're charged with is collecting reliable and comparable data and undertaking research in order to offer evidence-based advice to the Union and its institutions when implementing or considering community law in the field of fundamental rights. We're also charged with raising awareness throughout the Union with regard to fundamental rights. And lastly, we're charged with undertaking cooperation with civil society and other actors in that regard. We have no remit outside of the European Union, only for the 27 member states of the Union, and we have no capacity to engage in foreign policy on behalf of the Union. From our work there, though, and from my work with the OSCE, I've been very conscious also of the confusion between what I would call political ideology and religious ideology on one hand, and that sort of leading to increased designation of religious overtones to what might previously have been considered cultural matters. In other words, a slippery slope which makes certain things fashionable for as long as they line up with the political priorities of one state or another. And from that, the sort of hierarchies of oppression which emerge, which reflect the dominant political concerns of a particular time, have more of a capacity to change when the political concerns change than they have to change when resolutions to the real discrimination and persecution that underpins them is found. So that, for example, to look on the global stage in the latter half of the 20th century, for one period after the Second World War, persecution and discrimination against Jewish people was considered to be the priority. And if you look to the beginning of this century, in some parts of the West and Europe, discrimination and real discrimination against Muslim people is considered to be the priority. The reality that both forms of discrimination, and indeed very many other forms of discrimination and hate, continue unabated, is ignored. I have found also that discriminations need to be understood together, as well as targeted, if they are to be addressed. As a woman, I'm very conscious that if women in the second half of the 20th century, and perhaps not all of us women would have agreed with everything that was done in our on our behalves, but if women in the second half of the 20th century did not choose to actually name, as they saw it, the oppressions experienced by women, I don't think there'd be quite so many of us standing as I'm standing tonight. But at the same time, I'm equally conscious that although societies and discriminations are diverse, there are many things that link them together. Religious discrimination and religious intolerance and the right to practice one's religion freely can be linked with other discriminations and other intolerances. And I particularly note, with regard to religion, that those addressing those forms of intolerances, maybe because within the religions of which we are all part, there is a universe, that the capacity sometimes to look to others experiencing different but parallel forms of discrimination can be lacking. Diversity within religious movements and religions and within minorities experiencing discrimination also need to be understood. We're not all the same. Even those of us who belong to the same country and the same religion believe and experience differently. But we do share values. And defending the rights of people to practice their religion as they want to are defending rights for all. It's also been my experience that the most powerful are those who discriminate the most. And I have to say, when one looks to issues of addressing religious freedom, indeed, when one looks to issues of addressing discrimination in many areas, the most powerful, inevitably, are the states and those who act on behalf of states. And I have to say as well, because I think sometimes it applies to all of us in our different roles, possibly those most blind to being possible discriminators are state agents, educators, officials, academics, and dare I say, even judges, even although an eminent one will speak after me, who are blind to the possibility that the acts, the actions, and the decisions that we undertake as we pursue our daily work could have the capacity to be discriminatory against others. Finally, having told you a little bit about my country and the European Union, having outlined some of the areas that I have seen to be important and I have struggled to address in my work, let me say to you by way of conclusion, what's very clear to me, as someone who came through that period in my own country when people like to pretend, and maybe in that part of Europe as well, when people like to pretend that religion was a thing of the past, perhaps something, a cultural phenomenon to be dealt with as part of a family structure. Well, it's very clear to me as we move into this century is that the importance of religion cannot be underestimated, that it cannot be underestimated as providing a sense of value for people globally. It cannot be underestimated as providing a sense of comfort. And that the right to practice one religion is something which we still struggle to move from articulating as a right denied to being able to celebrate as a right that's claimed in its diversity throughout our world. Thank you.